It takes a lot of hard work to make it look easy. This Mother's Day, Duluth Trading Co. can help you give her something that keeps up. Whether you prefer to shop online or in-store, Duluth has a motherload of gear, goods, and gifts to keep her comfortable and capable, no matter what needs doing. With Duluth's problem-solving details and legendary durability to boot, you'll finally be mom's favorite again. Check out DuluthTrading.com for all your Mother's Day gifting needs.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Hello and welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music magazine. This week we're talking to Paul Morley, the pop journalist, musician and, more recently, classical music devotee. Brought up in Stockport, Paul cut his teeth in music journalism in Manchester. He then went on to write for the New Musical Express, where he rapidly became one of the paper's most respected critics, leading to regular appearances on radio and TV. In 1983, Morley and producer Trevor Horn founded ZTT Records, which soon hit both the top of the charts and the headlines with the release of Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Welcome to the Pleasure Dome album. In the same year, they also formed the group The Art of Noise, which had a string of hits, including a cover of Prince's Kiss featuring Tom Jones. In more recent years, however, Paul has turned his attention towards classical music, and in 2010 took part in a BBC 4 documentary called The Art of Composing, which saw him study at the Royal Academy of Music for a year. In 2020, he charted his developing interest in a new book called A Sound Mind, How I Fell in Love with Classical Music, which has now been published by Bloomsbury. Paul talked to BBC Music Magazine's deputy editor Jeremy Pound over Zoom during the second period of lockdown in England and told him how, from his pop and rock background, he gradually fell under classical music's spell.
Quite often in these interviews, Paul, my interviewee will say that they've picked up a violin at the age of 3 or 4, kind of from a very young age, or played the piano. But I understand that your kind of entry into music, both classical and pop, I guess, was fairly late on, was it?
Well, I started writing about music when I was very young. I was a young teenager. I'd always wanted to be a writer, and always found that when I was younger that the best way into being a writer was actually to write about music. So, yes, I wrote about music from a very young age. And as a critic, I started writing for the New Musical Express when I was about 18, 19. Making music came in different ways, really, because I worked in recording studios for a while when I worked with ZTT. I never learned to play an instrument. When I studied music at the Royal Academy of Music for a television programme, I couldn't believe at the beginning that I could actually study to be a composer without playing a musical instrument. And it was pointed out to me by the head of composition that it was quite feasible somehow to be able to compose music without playing an instrument, which was quite a liberation for me, really.
Yeah. So when you were very young, was there much music in your house at all? Or is it completely kind of something you discovered for yourself?
No, there was very little music in the house. That I've always found that quite interesting. That there was, I think there was a soundtrack to South Pacific, a Jerry Lewis EP, the American comedian, and I think one Johnny Cash album, but very little music. It was almost like I had to find music for myself. Almost driven to it in that sense, that the house seemed empty of music. And I suppose one of the odd places you would find it in the 60s when I grew up was on Top of the Pops, which took on a value probably far greater than it should have done in terms of the intensity of this regular date with music that happened every week. So I guess that's how I came into pop music so sort of solidly, that this was an escape route that I found as a very young child.
I think that's quite a familiar tale, actually, because I remember 7 o'clock Thursday evening was kind of a time imprinted on the memory. That was the one time you didn't want to miss. You had to be in front of the TV.
That's right. It's difficult to explain now that we're surrounded by music and the music is available everywhere all the time. That this was every week, this sudden sort of desert island would suddenly appear in your front room and you clambered onto it and felt rescued. You know?
And you had to grin and bear the last few minutes of Nationwide or something like that, wasn't it, before you had this.
There was always something strange before and after, yeah. And it was also something rather awkwardly that you sometimes did with all your family, whether you wanted to or not. Yeah. You know?
And now then, what was the first piece of classical music which kind of really caught your ear?
Well, it's interesting in terms of defining classical music in that sense. I suppose I've written a book about trying to sort of break out of those definitions. But thinking about the question, it occurred to me that it looks on paper as if it wasn't necessarily a piece of classical music, because it was by the musician, or non-musician in a way, Brian Eno, who I'd started following when he was in Roxy Music. And then he went solo from Roxy Music very early on. I didn't know much about his background. I was just a fan of Roxy Music. And he made one of the things he did when he left Roxy Music was he launched a record label called Obscure Records. Was in fact a sort of fascinating and fantastic study of modern minimalism, if you like, modern experimental music. It featured lots of people like Gavin Bryars and John Adams and John Cage. It was an extraordinary 10-record set of what would be called classical music, but because Brian Eno did it, it was almost still filed under pop. And Brian Eno himself had a record on there, Discrete Music, and it was instrumental music. So I suppose in a sense there was a definition of classical music for you, but I didn't think of it as classical music. And on there he did a kind of set of versions of an old canon in D major, Johann Pachelbel. I hope I pronounced that right.
You have indeed.
And to this day I'm still stumbling on pronunciation. And for me, it was just mesmerizing. It was a mesmerizing piece of music. I didn't think of it as anything in terms of its genre. It was just a very exciting piece of music that opened up incredible new territory for me in terms of what I liked. And then subsequently, I realized that Brian Eno had come out of a very particular background himself in terms of studying with Cornelius Cardew and being inspired by the American minimalists in the 60s, Lamont Young, Steve Rice. I knew none of this at the time. It was just another thing that one of my favourite pop stars had done. And at that time, you would avidly collect everything they did. He also made a record that was very important to me in 1973 with the guitarist from King Crimson, Robert Fripp, called No Pussyfooting, which was like a really exciting loop of guitar music fed through various machines to create this almost sonic sculpture. And again, I didn't think of it as being classical music or anything. I just thought of it as being an amazing piece of music, almost a religious artifact, if you like, that set me off into finding out where Eno himself had come from. So I think of those pieces as being very much one way into classical music. But what it did, in a way, was put me in touch with very much the experimental wing of classical music, and where it made contact with the experimental wing of rock music in terms of the electronic musicians of the 60s that came out of Germany, like themselves had come out of Stockhausen. So in a way, I'd made my first move into classical music, into its avant-garde areas. And I suppose for many decades, I sort of stayed on those shores. I didn't really move further in any direction from there because of all sorts of my own snobbery and I guess the snobbery I felt from within classical music. It didn't seem to be for me. So I stayed for a long time on those shores that had been inspired by Brian Eno.
You mentioned your book there, Sound Mind, How I Fell in Love with Classical Music, and I want to go back to that a little bit later. But it's interesting that Brian Eno were piece, of course, was based on Pachelbel's Canon, which has actually inspired quite a number of pop songs over the years, kind of from The Village People to The Lights of the Farm, and then Coolio as well, actually. So it's kind of almost like a recurring theme throughout pop as well, isn't it?
Well, it's funny that Pete Waterman of Stock Aitken and Waterman, for him, the bass rhythms and the structure of the music, the repetition of these bass notes, it sort of inspired all of Stock Aitken and Waterman's greatest hits. And it is interesting in terms of the Let It Be's as well by the Beatles and the Wonderwalls by Oasis. This pattern that Pachelbel had uncovered seems to have inspired an enormous amount of a certain sort of very addictive popular music. And it was incredibly funny to see that Pete Waterman was so sort of committed to what Pachelbel had done and basically stole a lot of those ideas to create this incredibly sort of popular high energy music from the 1980s. And I guess in a sense, I'd always found that as sort of one of the things that started inspiring me to think about classical music in a way. Once I did start thinking about it as a writer, was its enormous influence, certainly in its radical early avant-garde periods over time, that it influenced so much of popular music in terms of the way that it had leaked over, and that a lot of musicians would take a lot of the techniques and their knowledge of classical music to very unpopular classical music as well, if you like, to actually inspire a lot of the most popular music in the world. And I always thought that was quite fascinating.
In your own work with The Art of Noise, of which you're a member, the group The Art of Noise, there is, of course, leanings towards classical there, particularly in the album The Seduction of Claude Debussy. So obviously you had a particular kind of leaning towards him. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Once I'd started thinking a little bit more about a wider history of music, if you like, outside what I'd been writing about for 20, 30 years, so that would be the one that began, if you like, in the 1950s, popular culture, the teenage era, I started to get interested in where certain things emerged. And I got very fascinated with that period in the late 19th, early 20th century in France, the Ravel, Debussy, Satie period. And I suppose that was my first move away from the avant-garde shores, if you like, you know, trying to sort of create a map for myself of the history of classical music. I was also always interested when I would read about Bill Evans, who'd played with Miles Davis, talking about how he was influenced by the piano playing of that particular period. And I suppose as a writer, even when I was working with The Art of Noise, I was always interested in sort of investigating, if you like, certain histories and how things had happened. And it occurred to me, listening to more and more Debussy, especially Debussy and Ravel, that they were almost that a sort of strange period between the score being the way that music had been recorded and stored, if you like, and then what would happen in the 20th century when it was the recording studio was used to record and store music, that kind of incredible join between one period of history and another. And they seem to be the missing link, and they seem to be writing their music almost as if they were aware of multi-track techniques that would be used later in the 20th century. Their way of approaching composing music was very different from those that had come before. And it seemed to be that they were in their head using multi-track recording, the way they edited the music, the way that they layered it. It's something that would happen more and more once you could record music. But of course, they were just before those techniques. And so in a way, the Art of Noise Seduction of Claude Debussy album, which was made at the end of the 20th century, was a sort of homage, if you like, to the way that Debussy had invented many of the techniques that would be used later in the 20th century once there was sophisticated recording available. And I wanted to make that join between the two traditions, if you like, and honour that moment, that incredible sort of leap of the imagination when these musicians started to think ahead to when there would be different sorts of machines and different ways of recording and storing music. And I guess I decided that was, in a way, very much the beginning of 20th century music, not just because of its chronological position, but also the techniques that Debussy and Ravel were using.
And of course, it's a piece by Debussy, an opera by Debussy, which I understand was one of your most memorable concert or opera-going experiences ever. Can you tell me about that?
Well, Pelléas and Mélisande, certainly at the time, you know, I was beginning to, even in the last few years, opera's always been something that I've been very anxious about, if you like, for all sorts of reasons. And what I loved about, I mean, it was interesting. You've asked me four questions about pieces of music today, and at first every single answer was actually Debussy, so I had to pull out of that slightly because I suddenly thought, oh no, that sounds like I've actually learnt nothing in the last 20 years of this adventure I've been on, because all my answers are what they would have been 20 years ago, Debussy. But the opera, this one in particular, was obviously the only one that Debussy wrote. And I love that idea that he, I think he did it the same with the string quartet, really. He made one perfect one and then didn't have to do it again. And there's something about the experience of seeing it as well. It was I saw it at Glyndebourne, again, a place, and I write about this in the book, a location and a place that I've been very anxious about, and the whole sort of tradition that sort of seems set in stone and filled with secret code words that I didn't know. But the experience of seeing Debussy's opera was so extraordinary, because it's almost like an opera for people who don't really like opera. And it's so intense, and everything seems to be made of music. You know, the scenery seems made of music. The setting seems made of music. The characters seem made of music. It's a dream about a dream about a dream. And the world outside is very distant. And it seems to be an end of century piece of nervousness that made sense at the end of the 19th century and at the end of the 20th century, and became very well, you know, I played a lot again at the end of the 20th century, and I could understand why, because it's got that sense of what the hell do we do? All the characters just seem to be placed into existence and have to deal with it. And it seemed to, especially now as well, it seems to be a considerable help, and makes you realise how music does help you prepare and deal with extraordinary turbulent times. And it was such a hallucinatory experience actually seeing it live, that I started to begin to have a still ambivalent but increasingly intimate affair with opera, and I began to see its point, this creation of a fantasy, this creation of a world that seems so separate from the real world, seemed to have its benefits, that once you separated all the Glyndebourne-ness, the formalities, the obscure rituals that it seems to be involved, the strange sort of cultural elitism that was involved. Once you sort of broke through all of that and got to the pure essence of the experience and the music and the use of visuals and story and music, I mean, it was definitely an opera for non-opera lovers, but it's increasingly led me on to other operas. And I guess it was also, you know, realizing in terms of what I began to understand once I started to think more about classical music, his own sort of anticipation, his own desire to create an opera after Wagner, I thought was fascinating. You know, the next stage on, what would be the next stage on after Wagner? And I found this increasingly when I looked at the whole history of classical music, there'd be these moments where it seemed to have reached a certain climax, it couldn't go any further. And then someone comes along to take it further. And for me, this opera in particular was one of those moments where somebody seems to have gone as far as you could possibly go with the form and the format, and then someone comes along and takes it even further.
It's one of the fascinating things about classical music, isn't it? Is that although it seems as though it develops very organically, there are these figures throughout who are very aware of their position within the history of classical music and how they want to shape it next. And they actually do make this kind of conscious effort to take it in new directions.
Yes. I mean, that was something that was important to me in terms of breaking through some of the barriers I had about classical music, understanding the radicalism of the thinking, even if it was from the 17th, 18th, 19th century, that there was always radical moments, there was always transgressive moments, there was always moments of revolution, there was moments of moving on from something that had seemed to sort of become static and conservative with a small C. I was always fascinated that there was constantly someone coming along to work out what was happening next. And I'd never thought of this before because it had been presented to me, I guess, usually in a huge block of this is how it is, rather than understanding the radicalism of the composers who were involved. And I'd got fooled by chronology, if you like. I think that's why streaming was so important to me, because all the music suddenly existed all in one place. And instead of worrying that it might be 18th century or, you know, 1843 or 1756, it was just timeless, literally timeless. And you could start to piece it together in a different way, rather than worrying, you know, at what period of history it had actually come from, and thinking of the composers operating as artists in their own time, dealing with the stresses and crises they were in, and finding ways to use new instruments. For instance, you know, this was, you know, I write a whole chapter in the book on the piano. For that reason of suddenly realizing it came out of nowhere, and suddenly there was a whole way of dealing with the piano as a new instrument. And I'd never thought of that before, that was as radical in its time as the synthesizer was in the 1950s and 60s. And it was a big help for me, wanting to find a way in to deal with the music just as psychic energy, if you like, rather than worrying about the fashion and the context that had been given to it, and find a new context for it, if you like.
For me, After 20 years of working as a music journalist, I'm still kind of staggered and just about how large this subject is. What I know, even though I know quite a bit, is just a tiny little drop in the ocean. Are you finding that as well?
Well, yes. And the way I represented it in the book was I started doing playlists, and they would be maybe four or five pieces, and then six or seven pieces. And then by the end of the book, there's simply the final piece, is the final chapter is just a playlist, and it's probably hundreds of pieces of music. And I found that, and this is why streaming was so important, I think, as a liberation of discovering the music, is one piece leads to another piece, leads to another composer, leads to another instrumentalist, leads to another conductor. And it was endless. It was like infinite. And absolutely. And I think that was why I was always so disappointed with the way that the canon, if you like, had been presented to me, because it was so narrow and missed so much. And there was so much music that didn't seem to have been brought forward with the canon. And I suppose one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was not only to explore and explain something to myself, but also to point out all these different directions that you can go in, and these different minds and different sort of ambitions that they had, that it hadn't been just fixed in place. It was constantly mobile and fluid, and absolutely that you never stop. And you realize that you could just keep going on forever in this kind of labyrinth, if you like, you know, which for someone looking for something new in music, which I was at a certain age, was a tremendous sort of breakthrough. Because one of the things that started to happen is I realized, looking for new music, I always assumed new music meant music now that had just come out. And suddenly I realized that new music could just as much be from the 17th century or the 18th century, especially now when you can stream it, because it's now, it's available now. It's on your machine now. It's out now. And you can break free of that sort of time problem. And so, yes, I was finding new music from all over the last five, six centuries. And that was an incredible breakthrough as well, personally.
Now, of course, for all the discoveries of new music and the wonderful world out there, I presume there's one piece which maybe has been with you for a long time, which has been a real go-to and has kind of remained a favourite throughout all your classical listening.
Well, there is one piece. When I did the TV show, a couple of documentaries about how to be a composer at the Royal Academy of Music, the point was that I would write a piece of music. And I went through a little struggle about what this piece of music would be, because there was all sorts of revelations to me. I think another one, naively, for a long period of time, was the idea that classical music simply meant the symphony or the concerto, the big epic pieces of orchestral music. And it was one of those, again, breakthroughs of mine that I had. It probably sounds daft if you're experienced in this world, was the idea that a lot of the great classical music, of course, is small ensembles. It's solo pieces. It's intimate. It's very beautiful and lonely, and it's not the mass, the bombast. It's these incredibly personal pieces that come from often quite accidental ensembles of putting pieces of music together using certain instruments. Oh, I'll have that instrument, that instrument, and that instrument, which was a big help for me as a composer. Oh, I see. So one of the main things about composing a piece of music is the instruments you choose to, you know, to use. And after flirting with the idea out of pure ego of writing a symphony, I started to get very fascinated with the string quartet. And that was, quite a small leap for me in a way, because of my fascination within pop and jazz with a power trio or a jazz quartet or a quintet. You know, the idea of the four instruments. And I got, you know, first of all, I decided I would write a string quartet as my sort of piece for this particular television program. And then I started to listen to string quartets. And one of the first ones I listened to was the moment I fell in love with the string quartet was the second quartet by Shostakovich, which was just, you know, an extraordinary moment when I suddenly, those moments when you hear music and you suddenly fix on it and it makes sense. I had a similar experience with free jazz in the 1970s as a teenager, when it suddenly all made sense. And you don't hear it as difficult or strange or peculiar, but just as extraordinary contact with another person's mind. And so Shostakovich's second quartet, and then finding out all the other ones that he'd written, the 15 over a certain 3-4 decades, and realised that the work of art, if you like, came across time. But it all began with the second quartet. And every time I hear it now, I've still got that feeling which you get from a great piece of music, that every time I hear it, I'm still hearing it for the first time. And it seems itself to have changed shape, so that every time I hear it, it seems to have become something else. And in a way, that was my doorway into hundreds of years of the string quartet and hundreds of pieces of string quartet music. But that was the first piece, if you like. That was my awakening.
And of course, the second string quartet by Shostakovich, it's kind of got everything in it, hasn't it? Because it's got that very sort of folky start. And then you've got the romance, right, in the second movement, which is a slightly twisted, strange romance. It's not really... He's not playing ball. Yes. He's not playing straight, is it? It's kind of four very different movements. It's a really great way to introduce yourself to the string quartet repertoire.
That's right. And the idea of the four movements and the idea that there were these so-called restrictions that composers were constantly trying to battle with, not just the lineup, but the idea of the movements. And then obviously some people don't bother with the movements. So absolutely, it was luckily the perfect sort of introduction. I mean, I'd obviously loved the two that often get paired together, the Debussy and the Ravel quartets. And they were also incredibly, you know, in terms of my sort of playlist of string quartets, they would be high up there. But I think that the Shostakovich was another one of those moments that broke me free of some of my shackles, some of my routines, if you like, and showed me other places to go. And eventually another part of the book is a huge history of the string quartet I write, because I have this strange, nerdy desire always to then explain it to myself. So I don't, as a writer, I don't just hear the string quartet. I then want to explain the whole history to put myself in it almost, to put myself in the story itself about how did this happen and why did it happen and how come in 1944 or whenever he wrote it, why was he writing it then and how much was that up? And I want to be in that story. But then I realise it can't just be the story of Shostakovich. It has to be the story of the string quartet. So I have to piece that together.
Can you remind me and our podcast listeners again, when exactly the How to Be a Composer documentary was made? Was it about 2009, about then?
2010. Yes, it was on BBC Four. And on and off, informally, I studied composition at the Royal Academy of Music. And that was another interesting moment for me as a writer, is that I fell in love with the score as a kind of quasi-literary object. It was, I suddenly realised what it was doing and how it was transmitting information, and got very excited by that. And also that, like I say, for a long time, that was the way that music had been held in place, if you like. It was the only way that the information was transmitted forward before recorded music. So it became very mysterious and magical to me. And I realised that when technology collapses and all this stuff that we have at the moment goes down and the streaming sites disappear, there will still be these vessels carrying music forward, and gave you a kind of hope and optimism that even if things get a bit apocalyptic, there have been these methods and messages written into history that will keep things going.
Absolutely. Now, of course, although we have wonderful music history, there's always new recordings being made and new discs being produced. What is your current listening favourite, your most recent discovery?
I was trying to think of literally what would be the album this week. I think it is out this week. I'm not sure. Is it David Gruss? The pronunciation of this one would be...
Okay, it's David Grylshammer.
David Grylshammer, who I had a... he put together Scarlatti and Kaye sonatas a couple of years ago, two or three years ago. And I've always been interested in terms of those musicians who put together things from different periods of time. Because one of the things I found very interesting inside classical music, the institutions of it, the establishment, that they would be very protectionist, if you like, very defensive about putting things together that they think didn't belong. I remember there was an album that was a big, important one for me on ECM New Series, where there was Mozart put with Debussy. And I was really surprised when I read the reviews of this, that people were surprised that someone had put Mozart with Debussy. And I was surprised that they were surprised, because it seemed to make so much sense. And David is very much one of those musicians. In the book, I write about Joanna McGregor, a pianist who does this a lot, who put things together that the more sort of rigid establishment within classical music is surprised about composers being put together. And on Labyrinth, it's an extraordinary sort of mixture of the Baroque and the modern pianists. And it also has a sort of a concept to it, if that doesn't sound too laboured, where he's basically responding to the turbulence of the times. And this was before this year. I think he's been working on it for a couple of years, to essentially create a sort of a antidote, if you like, to the oddness of the times. And I was reading reviews of this particular record. He puts Mozart on there, Johann Bach, CPE Bach, all sorts of different places from the Baroque to now. And even then, people seem to be reviewing it as if this was startling. And they were saying, well, at first it does look like a random list. The idea that he would be putting this together as if there was no real sort of method behind it. It was just simply, oh, I'll just play all this sort of stuff and it doesn't connect. But for him, it was very much a way of basing it around Lajos Janáček's Overgrown Path and using that as a central spine and creating his path of other composers as well. And did that thing that I really love, where it's not that he's just dabbling or just putting things together that don't belong with each other. He's not just sort of being some kind of random DJ slicing things up and mashing things together in an arbitrary manner. There's a purpose to what he's doing. And it is this sense that he's putting together radical minds, transgressive minds from different periods of time into one space and calling it Labyrinth. And I'd often thought of the whole history of classical music as being a kind of labyrinth and an endless maze. And it just seems to be also with my own exploration of making playlists, which seems to be a very contemporary way of responding to music, is that he essentially has made a kind of playlist and then played it himself. And it's another one of those records that I love because it seems to break some of the patterns of classical music that you're not supposed to break. It's transgressive in itself by putting these composers together in one place that's never been done before. Seems to cause still, strangely, some alarm in the classical world, whereas for me it seems the most natural thing to do, and I wish there was more of it. And indeed, I wish there was more of it that breaks free and not of classical itself as well and breaks sort of outside of that world and puts things together. I think one of the motivations to write the book, in a way, was to break down some of these genre barriers and borders that seem to sort of create alcoves where people nestle into them and don't break out. I don't know what the ultimate purpose of it is if you do break out of these alcoves, but it seems more healthy and more exciting that you do, that you move around more. And this record, Labyrinth, seems to be, for me, one of those classical albums that does that. It isn't a series of set pieces by one composer or two or three composers that usually get put together, but is trying to find a new route through, you know, obviously the overgrown path.
I love the fact as well that you've selected one track for us from this album to play. And as a journalist, that you've actually gone from the Overgrown Path, the movement called Words Fail.
Yes. And what's funny about that is at the end of my book, in the long playlist that ends the book, coincidentally, it is the last piece on that playlist, which was a complete coincidence. I knew that he'd been doing this, but I'd never seen actually the kind of things that he was playing. And I thought it was incredibly fitting that the last piece, in fact, the last words in that sense of the book, Words Fail, was in fact on this record. And I thought, oh, that must mean something. I've made some sense of the universe by the fact that that's happened. This record that I was really starting to like and didn't even know that had happened at first is in fact the last piece on my incredibly long final playlist in the book, which to some extent is my conclusion about the music, and a conclusion is Words Fail.
Excellent. And I think that is a wonderful moment at which to, rather than wonderful point at which to round up our little podcast. Thank you very much for this, Paul. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
That was journalist and author Paul Morley on the classical music that has shaped his life. Paul's new book, A Sound Mind, How I Fell in Love with Classical Music, is out now, published by Bloomsbury. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Tune in next week, where we'll be speaking to another fascinating figure from the music world about their enduring musical loves. Do let us know what you think of this podcast by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats across the world. Or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read about all the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.